This is Dick Hain, and it's a session called South Africa and Ethiopia, What We Can Do. I'm very strongly inclined to begin this session with, I don't know whether to begin with it or end with it. I guess we may not get there if I don't begin with it. There are a lot of different things that we can do generally when it comes to changing what's going on in the world. Washington, D.C. is the most powerful city in the world in our generation. In a sense, New York. New York for culture. The dissemination of culture. Washington, D.C. for power. Some of you have heard my story of the guy who goes to my church and works for a senator. And after church, he sings in the choir. He sings in the choir, crosses himself. After church, the choir goes to lunch. He says, well, I got to go back to work this afternoon. I can't hang around too long. Someone says, oh, you have to work on a Sunday afternoon? He says, yeah, I got to go back and cut $500 million out of the military budget this afternoon before a committee hearing tomorrow morning. Just like that. $500 million. Yeah. Weapon systems of one kind or another. They're there and then they're not there. My bottom line through all of this time, I've had, I guess, two kind of things I've been trying to say for 2 weeks. And I've said them every chance I get. One is that however hard it is, however incremental it is, and it's a tough incremental business, it's a, if you're gonna be fully utopian, then politics is not for you, because utopians go found utopian communities. And there's a place for that. I wouldn't say a word against that. That's a good thing because it shows us how things might go. It helps us work out alternative strategies for dealing with the world. But for some of us, politics is a vocation. It is a calling like unto a religious calling. It is through politics that roads do or do not get built, education does or does not happen, people do or do not get fed, millions of dollars go this or that way. Weapon systems get adopted or rejected. It's just an enormously powerful, large thing. It affects the taxes you pay. It affects whether people have jobs, what the economy is going like. It's just incredible. Social Security is an example for a lot of people. We could be facing some cuts in Social Security payments. Well, who's going to decide that, and on what basis are they going to decide it, and is it good or is it bad, and who's going to get hurt, and who's going to get helped, and all that kind of stuff is political. It's all political. There are a lot of ways to operate politically. Bread for the World is a church-based Christian organization. So we operate in a style that mainline church people can identify with. You're not going to find Bread for the World doing some kind of radical far-out thing, okay? Because that's not our constituency. That's not who we are. What we can help you with is we can provide you with information when you have a phone. We can provide you with phone calls when a bill is about to be acted on, and we have telephone networks all over the country that will activate and call. You know, we know there's a vote Friday. I call local people on Tuesday or Wednesday. They call people on their telephone tree, and all of a sudden 50 phone calls come in about third world debt. I mean, how many people in your average town are going to call Congress about third world debt? Zero. Unless you mobilize them. Unless you mobilize them. And then there can be dozens of calls, and it does make a difference over the long term. Not every time, not every letter, not every phone call, but the cumulative effect really does influence the way Congress does business. So I think that's important. Letters, phone calls, Letters to the editor, we'll provide you with sample letters to the editor. Opinion editorials, guest editorials, we'll write them for you. All you have to do is put your name on it, send it in the local newspaper. And the smaller the town, the more likely they'll publish it, frankly. It's a lot easier to get a guest editorial in the Yakima, whatever it is, than it is in the Dallas Morning News, which is, you know, got a lot of demands on its space. All of those things. Visits with members of Congress. We'll help train you to do that. We'll go with you when we can. You'll find other people to go with you. Sit down and talk to them. That's a fairly powerful thing. When I was in Fort Worth, Texas, Jim Wright was Speaker of the House. Bread for the World called. Said, we want you to go talk about the situation in Angola and Mozambique. And I said, well, that's nice, but I don't even know exactly where Angola and Mozambique are, let alone what's going on there. I mean, it's just, you know, there's things you know and things you don't know. And so they said, yeah, but we got to talk to Wright about Angola and Mozambique. So I said, well, I'll try to find somebody to do it. Well, I couldn't find anybody, so I went. Along with two other Bread for the World members. And they put somebody on the phone with me in Washington, D.C., John Prendergast. John is a really bright guy. And he just came on the phone, and he spent half an hour, 45 minutes, up giving me a kind of what's going on in Angola and Mozambique. And so three of us went, one to talk about WIC, one to talk about micro-enterprise in third world countries, and one to talk about situation in Angola and Mozambique. We got half an hour with the Speaker of the House. Can't get that in Washington, D.C. You can't get that. You can get that. Local people can get time with their members of Congress that we can't get ordinarily in D.C. because you're their constituents. You're the people that have the power. We provide the information. Yeah, we lobby. Yeah, I've lobbied on Capitol Hill. Mostly what I get when I lobby on Capitol Hill is an aide. What you can get is a member of Congress. You can get their time. We got half an hour with Jim Wright the week before. Oh, thank you. Not sure how this...
Well...
If you'll just do me,
okay.
I'm yours, okay?
How's that? Now you're transmitting.
Can you... I think the microphone's upside down. Let me turn this around the other way. You'll get my heartbeat.
Okay, good.
If you quit getting a thumpa, 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 wave your hand.
And are you hearing his heartbeat?
No, I was just kidding. Can you hear that okay?
Fine.
Okay, good. It was the week before Jim Wright met with Daniel Ortega. And we talked about Angola and Mozambique. He wanted to talk about Central America, so we talked about Central America. Did we have an influence on his position? Maybe, maybe not. I can't, you know, I could say yeah, but yeah is a cheap answer. I don't know. You know, I don't know. But he wanted to talk, and we spent about 20 minutes out of the half hour talking about Nicaragua and what we could do about Nicaragua and stuff like that. You have a lot of potential, a lot of access, a lot of basis on which to influence these people. You're their constituency. And all we try to do is help you. We try to act as mediators and guides, provide information when you need it, hang in with you. You get discouraged, you have a meeting at church, nobody comes. Okay, well, I'll come by your church, you know, when, next time I'm in your area. I'll come by and I'll meet with the pastor, I'll meet with a committee, try to support you, try to find somebody else in your town who's a member who will hang in with you, somebody who will give you some support in the things you want to do. That's what we do. I had this data up on the board last week, but most of you weren't here last week. It bears some repetition. It often seems like nothing's changing. I know that. I mean, I work this stuff every day, and I know it at least as well as you do, that you know, you work and you work and you work, and it seems like it doesn't make a difference. Sometimes you have to look at the long term, okay? In 1900, the life expectancy for white males was 47.3 years in this country. For black males, it was 33 years in 1900. In 1970, life expectancy was 70.9 years for whites and 65.3 years for black males. In 1916, there were 60.8, let's see, is this maternal or infant? I've got that here somewhere. There it is. In 1916, maternal mortality rate per 10,000, should be 10,000, not 1,000. Could be another zero in there. The maternal mortality rate per 10,000 live births, that is to say the women who died in childbirth, for 10,000 live births was 60.8 for whites and 117.9 for blacks. In 1970, it was 1.4 for whites and 5.6 for blacks. In 1870, there was not a single acre of U.S. parkland. Yellowstone was started in 1872. In 1970, there were 35 national parks with 14 million acres. Somewhere here, I guess I have misplaced the sheet on which I had this information, but I also had something about education. Something like 2%, as I recall, 2% of Americans were college graduates in 1870, and now it runs something like 60% or something like that. 1865 is slavery. That's not very long ago, okay? 2021, women got the vote. That's not very long ago. You know, lots of people are alive today who were alive when women got the vote. Lots and lots and lots of people. At least nationally. In some states, they had the vote before. Why did all of that stuff happen? Because local people worked on school boards. Because people just like you and me did health care. Nurses and doctors and researchers did, you know, stuff on polio. The polio, I'm old enough to remember when polio was a major threat, and my mother didn't want me to go swimming in the summer because of the danger of polio. Not sure.
It's a bus leaving.
Oh, okay. Is it over? All of those things happened because of the nobodies of history, like us, I mean, essentially. Sure, you hear about Martin Luther King Jr., you hear about, you know, Mother Teresa, Albert Schweitzer, and Nobel Prize winners, Dorothy Day. And they are wonderful guides and models and examples. But in fact, without people like you and me, they don't exist. I mean, those are little blicks in the whole scheme of things. And without people to hang in there and do that work day after day, week after week, month after month, year after year, it doesn't happen. We're the people that change history. We are the people that bring salvation, in a sense, salvation in quotes, to the earth. Would really like to read you this letter, but I also need to talk about South Africa and sanctions. Maybe I'll save the letter for toward the end, if we have time. Say a little bit about South Africa and Ethiopia and sanctions and so forth. We've taken some heat from some of our members, about the fact that we work for comprehensive sanctions against the government of South Africa, and we have for a number of years. Bread for the World is one of the largest, strongest citizen advocacy networks in the country. We have a core of activists that other organizations are jealous of. They come to us to get us into coalitions because we've got people who are doing something, and because we've got a large group of people. A lot of organizations in Washington from which you get mail are just that, organizations that send out a little mail. They are think tanks. They are idea people. They don't invest in grassroots organizing. We have 10, 11, 12 people who do what I do, grassroots political organizing, all over the country. Speak to churches, meet with people, support them, listen, talk. Mostly I talk, I know, but I do know how to listen. And so we're really invested in this grassroots network, and we work on emergency feeding where needed and structural change. We much prefer structural change. Give me structural change over a food pantry any day. There are lots of food pantries. There are lots of people working on it. There are 10 times as many food pantries today as there were, say, 10 years ago, and yet there are also 10 times as many hungry people. Why? Because the system grinds them out faster than your local food bank can take care of them. So you have to do some changes in the structure, some changes in the system. In the case of South Africa, it is a wonderful thing to bring a South African student to the United States so we can learn. It is a wonderful thing to listen to Simon Ferrisani speak about his experience of being tortured in South Africa. And I'm sure that a lot of you have heard him. He was Dean of Lutheran Church in Venda, and how they would they arrested him, and they would grab him by his arms and legs, and four different people would hold him, and they kind of lift him up, and then they let go and drop him. How they would hang him out a window by his heels. How they would do electric shock torture. It's a horrible, horrible situation there. I mean, it's just incredible. It's mind-boggling that on the face of this earth, things like this happen. And yet they do. And they continue to happen, not only there, but particularly there. We like to go for structural changes. What will change the system that causes poverty and hunger instead of always doing the band-aids? And that's tougher in a sense. And it's not as satisfying in some sense. I mean, if you're doing direct food feeding, you get to see somebody who's hungry, you get to talk to them. We're always working at the system level, and that takes a real tenacity because it takes a long time. And you don't see immediate changes always, and you don't see the people who benefit. Most of the people who benefit from the stuff we do will never see us, will never know we exist. We are completely anonymous to them. So we, in the case of South Africa, the question, it comes down to changing the system of apartheid. Until apartheid is no longer the official policy of the government of South Africa, Black people in South Africa will not be able to feed themselves, will not be able to have health care and so forth. Let me just give you a few statistics on the situation in South Africa and then talk a little bit about sanctions. Blacks constitute about 72% of the population, whites about 13% of the population. I'm sorry, that's not right. 13? Yeah, 13% of the population. Let's see, 72, that's not right. 72 and 20, can't figure out my own figures here.
No, I think 13% is right.
13%? Let's see. Blacks make up, this says 74% of the population. Okay, the 13% is the percent of the land they live on. 72%, 72 to 74, I've seen different figures. 72 to 74% of the population live on 13% of the land. As you may know, blacks were, a lot of blacks, most of them, were forced to live in the Bantustans, or the so-called homelands, black homelands. Generally speaking, that land is not arable, it is not viable for agricultural purposes. Generally speaking, there are exceptions, but the best land is held by the small part of the population, and the worst land is held by the great 74%, 72 to 74% of the population. Urban unemployment for blacks ranges from 20 to 40%. For whites, 2%. The average white earns $5 for every dollar that an urban black earns. Infant mortality for blacks in South Africa runs 282 per thousand births. 282 per thousand births. That's almost 20, that's over 25%, right? 282 per thousand. More than 25% infant mortality, the highest in the world. For whites, it runs 12 per thousand. Most of that, the majority of that infant mortality occurs among rural blacks and is due to malnutrition. I don't have at hand the education statistics. I have them back in the office, didn't bring them with me. But if you look at number of teachers, number of doctors, the figures are phenomenal. Number of doctors runs something like one for every, 800 or 500 whites, and one for every 10,000 or 15,000 blacks. I mean, the figures are just so outsized, so egregiously unequal that it's just, you can't, you've got to see that what the apartheid system creates. Apartheid's fairly new, only since 1948 as official policy. It has not been policy for 100 years. And groups like the African National Congress have been dealing with racism since the early 1900s. Bread for the World has a background paper on hunger and apartheid. Again, our members want to know why, if you're a hunger organization or you're working on sanctions, they don't immediately see the connections between them. Is that better? No? Did I turn it off or something accidentally?
It needs to be on.
Power on.
I don't get it.
Are you getting anything?
No, I'm not getting anything.
Maybe I wiggled the cord here or something.
You're not getting anything at all?
Mm-hmm. Oh, wait a minute. What's this? Oh, that's an antenna.
That's the antenna.
Just cut off all of a sudden.
Really?
All of a sudden,
gone. Nothing. Well, I'm sorry.
That's all right.
It may be a loose connection here or something like that. I don't know.
I can hear enough.
Can you?
Let me check the battery up.
Yeah. Okay. Or if you have another set while you're doing that.
Yeah, I'll just bring in the other set.
Okay. Thank you. You might want to look at, I have two of Bread for the World's newsletters here. This one is focused on apartheid. And the way our newsletter works, if you want one, I don't want to force a lot of paper on you that you don't want. Take one if you would like one. The way it works is, each month there's one issue that's focused on, and then on this right here, there's an action for the month, a very specific targeted thing that you can do, and write a letter, either as a member of a local group, or a group of people who meet each month, or just sitting at home in your own home. I mean, even housebound, homebound people can write a letter. It's something that homebound people can make a phone call. You don't have to be terribly mobile or able to get out to meetings, because this comes 10 times a year.
This goes to the Resource Center over here, right?
Here it's in the Resource Center. Yeah, there is a copy in the Resource Center. Our feeling is that sanctions work. The United States adopted limited sanctions, and they have had a limited effect. Since 1985, the government of South Africa has spent $10 billion to try to circumvent the sanctions and to find alternative markets. Why did South Africa pull out of Namibia? Because of sanctions. Because they could no longer withstand the economic pressure and the moral pressure of the community of nations. Why is South Africa willing to withdraw troops from Angola? Not because of a great change of heart, but because of sanctions, because they are hurting economically, because they cannot afford to sustain the level of financial commitment to their troops that were in Angola. It is estimated that, I don't have an exact dollar figure here, but one of the losses that they have undergone is they have a $22 billion foreign debt. Why are changes happening now? Because they're having to reschedule a lot of that debt. Those debts, short-term loans are coming due, and they don't have the foreign exchange to pay all of those debts. When you borrow money on the international scene, as I understand it, and I'm not expert in all of these issues, I can't be expert in all of the issues that BRED covers, or maybe even any of them. When you borrow on the international scene, you have to pay back in either the currency of the country from which you borrow or US dollars. So if you have borrowed from Chase Manhattan, or you have borrowed from the United States government or in some other manner, you have to pay that back in US dollars. Well, where are you going to get US dollars? You have to sell something on the world market to get the cash. Are you getting something there? Maybe it's your unit that's the problem. Maybe it's the other end.
It sounds like it's, you're getting it now, aren't you?
Are you getting it? No? It must be that one then. Because
that's all right. I'm hearing quite well.
Are you?
As long as you keep your head up.
All right. So, you know.
People start going like this.
Yeah. Muttering. You have to get foreign exchange to service your debt. Those debts, those notes started coming due this year, and a whole bunch more will be coming due next year. Why did they release Nelson Mandela? Partly because they didn't want him to die in jail, frankly. I mean, and he's now of an age, and his health has been a little shaky. He was in the hospital not too long ago, that they wanted to let him out, partly because of sanctions, and there are, of course, partly because of pressure from some white people and large groups of black people in South Africa. It's going to be quite a struggle there. I've talked to Chief Buthelezi of the Zulus, too, and he sees himself as the great hope, and of course a lot of white people see him as the great hope too, because he opposes sanctions. It was a little bit bizarre. A group of very anti-sanctions people in Fort Worth, Texas brought Chief Buthelezi to speak at one of the country clubs in Fort Worth, and I happened kind of by accident to get an invitation to that thing. And I went partly because that was a country club that as recently as probably 5 years ago never let a black in the front door. And first of all, I wanted to see if they let Buthelezi come in the front door. And second of all, I wanted to hear what he had to say while he was there. But it's a very troubled situation. Already in 1985, banks began to refuse to roll over some of these debts. And because of that, the South African economy has continued to deteriorate. And so there are two major sets of bills before Congress, two major concerns right now. One is that sanctions not be removed. Symbolic gestures are nice. Mandela's doing a lot of good stuff. The poster in the Village Center is right. Mandela's free, but he can't vote. These things are still very superficial. Fundamental change has not happened in South Africa. We're on the edge. We're on the cusp. Some very good things are happening. We cannot be deluded by these apparent and early changes into believing that somehow now everything's going to be okay. The government of South Africa, Prime Minister, is that what he's called? De Klerk.
Well, now he's president.
President.
The new constitution.
Okay. Has been absolutely clear that he does not see in any time a one person, one vote in South Africa. That's not even in his imagined scenario. And so there's just not fundamental change happening there, although things have been moving along. In 1993, again, there's going to be a lot of debts coming due. And a lot of groups, including manufacturers Hanover Trust and J.P. Morgan, those two banks are going to have a lot to say about whether South Africa's debts get rolled over another time. And so there is a bill before Congress to put certain conditions on the rescheduling of debts. It's a bill for financial sanctions. That is to say, to be sure that if they want these debts rescheduled, what they're wanting is short-term notes turned into long-term notes and no payments for a while. They want to turn them into notes that come due, let's see, when is it? The year 2000. And they want to not pay any principal between 1994 and 1997, and they want to hold on some of their interest payments and so forth. So there is a bill, H.R. 3458, that would put certain conditions on the rescheduling of some of these notes so that some further changes would be encouraged along the way. And they wouldn't just automatically get these notes recycled. So what we can do on that, it's really not that different than what we can do on a lot of public policy issues. We need to keep pressure on Congress not to withdraw. The president would like to withdraw comprehensive sanctions. Change is happening. We need to show a gesture of support. That's fine. Let's show a gesture of support, but let's not remove the pressure that is fueling, and there may be some support in Congress for the financial sanctions bill. So something people can do is letters and phone calls around the issue of financial sanctions. And there's a whole lot of provisions, staggered provisions, 6 months, 12 months, 2 to 3 years, 5 years. There's a whole set of provisions in the financial sanctions bill, which I think I could read to you, but I think it would just be confusing. I think it helps to have the stuff in print. Say a little bit about the Horn of Africa. This particular issue of the newsletter was about part of what's going on in the Horn, though not the whole thing. Of course, as you know, the greatest threat of starvation right now is occurring in the Horn of Africa. If you look at a map of Africa sidewise, I don't know, the light may be going through this, but if you think of this as a rhinoceros head, this part right here is sort of like a horn. This would be the face, I guess, or head, if you will. The Horn of Africa includes Ethiopia, Somalia, Sudan, Tigray. Well, Sudan's just a little off the horn. Tigray, Eritrea. Essentially what's going on there is totalitarian rule and civil war, in a few words. A civil war in which food is used as a weapon. It's not so very long ago when the U.S. The administration a few years back said, great, we've got lots of food, other countries need it, we'll use food as a weapon of public policy. Well, food is being used as a weapon in Ethiopia, and primary cause of hunger in Africa is militarization. Budgets that are going to fuel military machines rather than for rural development. In Angola, landmines being, that's in southern Africa, but landmines made just outside Shreveport, Louisiana on Goodwill Road. Would you believe that? There's an ammunition, when you go down the road to outside of Shreveport, it says ammunition plant, Goodwill Road. Somebody with a kind of quirky sense of humor must have named that road. But they make landmines there, and those landmines were being shipped to Angola. I'm switching now from the Horn to southern. And those landmines, but it kind of describes the way some of this happens. Those landmines are put in farmers' fields. They're put in roads, school kids having their legs blown off, walking to school, farmers trucking a little bit of grain or whatever it is they grow. I mean, I don't know that much about the local products. Trucking stuff to a local market, you know, getting their legs blown off with landmines, courtesy of the U.S. government. The point is that the disruption of agriculture is a strategy of war. Burn the fields, turn the local people into refugees, drive them off their land, withhold money from them, pollute the waters, surround the towns, starve them out. These are all traditional weapons of war, not terribly surprising. Been going on that way ever since. Ever since there's been war, I guess. The weapons are a little more sophisticated, but the strategies are essentially the same. So what we have worked on, we and other groups, it's not like we're the only gang in town. We work in coalitions with South Africa groups, with groups from the Horn of Africa and so forth. We have been working on cross-border trucking operations. And I was going to grab out of the resource center on the table in the resource center right this minute, or at least yesterday afternoon, the Lutheran. This week's The Lutheran has an article on the cross-border trucking operation. And the way that works is that both the United States government and multilateral agencies and other nations make funds available and urge the two sides of the conflict not to shoot at the trucks. Try to get a truce on both sides, on the part of both sides. And then that money actually goes to Catholic Relief, Lutheran World Relief, and there's another group listed in the Church World Service, I guess. And they actually have the trucks, ship the food, drive it through this war zone to make the food available to local people who are starving. So at the moment, that's the best thing we can do. Long-term strategies, of course, include relieving some third world debt, not contributing our money toward civil wars in third world countries. All of this is part of the Harvest of Peace resolution, by the way. I've de-emphasized that part because it's a little harder to explain. But there is a line in there about reducing our contribution to third world conflicts. Rural development, just a whole bunch of strategies. Yeah.
Because of its geographic location, what kind of a role do you see Kenya playing?
I'm afraid I don't know enough about the area to comment. Maybe someone else here does.
The thing that's happening is that the government in Kenya just recently, in about the last year or so, has been getting some real bad press. And before that, they were pretty stable. And since they were a democracy, and what's happening to the democracy of that Kenya? I was there in 85, and things were very nice, and you know, everybody's good with the kite. But I thought because of its location, it should be in a very sensitive spot.
Yeah. Don't know enough about that local stuff to comment, I'm afraid. Jane, do you have a comment? Looks like you're
barbaric. No, I don't have a response to that. I have a different question.
Well, I'm just struck, and I think what you're saying is really true. I mean, Kenya has to be the base of at least relief operations, and certainly, I mean, any other kind of supply into Sudan. In southern Sudan, you are so far from any port directly in Sudan, there's just no possibility of getting relief from the north. It has to come up from Kenya. And just like you say, it's true, it has been a democracy, it's getting more and more oppressive, but probably the U.S. will have to continue to support it. I mean, I think it shows not, we don't always start supporting terrible regimes, but sometimes they are good and they are necessary for something, and then we keep supporting them while they go way past democracy. Kenya is really, I think we'll have to keep supporting it.
In Sudan, we're trying to get a reduction of U.S. military, that kind of stuff. Yeah.
Well, I have a sort of a tough question.
That I would say I agree with you. In Ethiopia, the conflict is primarily, it's a military thing that is starving people, and it's also oppressive policies of that Marxist government.
Right.
But I would also say that I think, in my opinion, Ethiopia suffers from some level of overpopulation, and the land is wearing out in some cases. And I guess one thing that really bothers me about the Reagan administration and now the Bush administration is that they have cut funding for overseas family planning programs because they say that, I mean, I would say it's bowing to the right-wing groups in our country, the anti-abortion people especially, who say that if there's any, if any of these organizations that do family planning overseas have anything to do with abortion, then the U.S. has to quit funding them. And I really oppose that policy change. What's Bread for the World's position on that, though? Because I know you have a lot of Roman Catholics in your organization. It's probably a really touchy issue. But in my opinion, any response that we have, even to trying to cut militarization and do relief development, anything like that, also there has to be funding for family planning overseas. And I don't believe it's right to withhold that just because organizations have abortion as part of their program.
Right. Yeah, Bread for the World is about 40% Catholic. The largest group of constituents we have are Catholic, and of course Catholics themselves are divided about that issue, as are Lutherans, Baptists, Methodists, and Presbyterians for that matter. But not because of that constituency. I was reading in Seeds magazine here one of the issues by Oxfam. So Oxfam doesn't have that kind of stake, that same stake, say, constituency stake that we have. What does Oxfam say when you ask, is population a primary cause of world hunger? They say no. All of the hunger organizations pretty much say the same thing. The population is not a primary. It may be a contributory, but it is not a primary cause of hunger. That there is plenty of food in the world, will be, unless major droughts, to the year 2000 at least, 2010. And that, you know, all of the data shows that when you raise educational levels, when you raise income levels, people voluntarily choose to limit their population. And until you've done that, they haven't.
I would disagree with that on Ethiopia. I really, you know, I think there are countries in Africa that are underpopulated, definitely, and that overall Africa has enough food. But I would say that Ethiopia has a really high population density, and it's clear that, I guess... All right, well, let me just ask you directly, what is Bread for the World's policy on this issue?
On population control?
Yeah.
Well, I've just stated it. We don't approach the problem through population control, but through raising the standard of living. That seems to be the more effective strategy. See, if you're going on a country-by-country basis, Holland has something like 1,000 people per square, what is it, mile or something, or per square acre. The number of people, Manhattan, has an awful lot of people per square inch. But that doesn't mean that you know, that the population per square whatever is not a good indicator of the extent of hunger. Now, I'm not saying that, I don't know what the figures are for you, and I'm not really trying to disagree with you at all, really not. But you've asked me what Bread for the World's position on this is. And we may have differing positions in the room, and that's fine. That's great. I mean, I have no problem with diversity. Bread for the World's position, along with Oxfam and most groups that work on hunger, is that the strategy for the primary strategy for dealing with the question of population is to raise the standard of living. And you can't always look at it on a country-by-country basis. But there are problems with not looking at it on a country-by-country basis, too, for that matter. So that is, there's a big argument going on, you know, whether these things are international and should be viewed internationally, or whether they should be national and viewed nationally. When you talk about rural development, you know, should this be done primarily on a country-by-country basis, or should we be looking at solutions to these things on a kind of global scale? And there are genuine differences of opinion, each with a convincing set of arguments on that kind of stuff. Is that
Yes, I'm just hoping that you're going to talk about Ethiopia. Is there something that we can be writing about for Ethiopia? Because for me, that is a great hole in whatever, I mean, anything that's going.
Yeah, it's not specifically.
Because, for example, this newsletter talks about Sudan, and that's where the U.S. is supporting the government.
In Ethiopia,
of course, it's the opposite. There was a, just a few days before I came up here, there was a very, very moving footage on Nightline, not a show that I watch very often, but it happened to. I don't know if anybody else saw that. As Ted Gobble said, I mean, if this were anywhere else in the world, this would be getting daily headlines. Mm-hmm. Thousands of people are dying every day, and it could easily be millions. I mean, it's just it's an incredible problem. And we just kind of push it away because Ethiopia, we've heard so much about Ethiopia. And besides, mm-hmm. it's the Soviet government that is the main support right. of these bombs that are killing people.
Right.
So what can we do as Americans in this terrible situation?
Yeah, we put out for a limited number of members a one sheet page that gives 8 different things that can be done in relationship to the Horn of Africa. That we it says, write your representatives and senators and urge that the United States, one, a continue halt on non-humanitarian aid to Sudan and Somalia until peace agreements are implemented. Urge other nations in the Arab world, Soviet Union, and Israel to withhold military aid from either side of the warring parties. Oppose loans not given for humanitarian purposes from the World Bank, the IMF, International Monetary Fund, Sudan, Somalia, and Ethiopia. There's a whole series of things that are, and there was, when I left the office, some emergent specific legislation on Ethiopia. And frankly, I've been away from the phone for 2 weeks, and they were supposed to mail that to me, and the person that was supposed to do that didn't mail it. So I don't have a bill number on Ethiopia right now. But there was some emergent legislation specifically on Ethiopia to target. And so there are like 8 different things. And I can leave this here. I don't need to take it with me. If you want to write or have one or two people write on the subject of Ethiopia, I would be glad to leave that specific list of things there that we think can be of help. Barbara?
Well, I was just going to say on that, I was there in 86, so that was a couple years ago. But one other component of what had been going on with the Marxist government there was severe persecution of churches. And the Lutheran Church was hard hit by that. That was when we visited most. Just being Lutherans, but every other Christian church, I mean, there was a real crackdown on the churches and torture and imprisonment of many members and closing down congregations. But what the church was finding by 85 and 86 was that the food aid that the U.S. government was sending through organizations like Lutheran World Service and Church World Service, Catholic Relief Service, was really helping church people in the sense that they were able to administer the food programs and the persecution was lessening because the church was seen as doing good work. And I mean, I know giving food is just a handout again. In Ethiopia, the really painful thing is that it's encouraging the government in its resettlement policies, which are really oppressive. I mean, they are forcibly resettling people like in South Africa. I mean, it's really terrible. And they can get away with it in part, they can keep the people alive by using U.S. food aid to do some of that. On the other hand, it is keeping people alive, and it's saving lives. There's no question about what Relief Assistance is doing that there, even if you are playing into the hand of oppressive government policies. And it's also saving the church, I would say. I mean, we saw church leaders who said, our suffering is a lot less now than it was 2 years ago, and it's thanks to this food aid. So please tell your people to keep sending sacks of food, and they see that it, I mean, it's, they know that it's Christian people and Western governments that are doing it, and they are very appreciative of that.
What I would like to, thank you, that's helpful. What I would like to see personally, I've begun to do a little work on food security. There's going to be big discussions, you'll be reading about in the newspaper, the GATT negotiations, General Agreement on Trades and Tariffs, finishes the Uruguay round this fall. And the administration has proposed international free trade, essentially. The common market, European common market, doesn't think that's so wonderful. Japan doesn't think that's so wonderful. And some other countries. There's a group of 74 developing nations that don't think it's exactly so wonderful the way we put it. But we begin to have some world impetus on democracy and peace. When Ortega can put the presidential sash around Violeta Chamorro's neck in the face of international pressure for democracy and elections, that's a pretty powerful event. When the international community can rise up and say, apartheid and racism are no longer acceptable in this world, anywhere, that's a pretty powerful event. What I would like to see is, as this world ethos begins to emerge, that there begin to be a world ethos that says, no child shall go to bed hungry anywhere. Food security, that people would be guaranteed by one process or another, though they may have different forms of government and different economic systems, that they would be guaranteed access to secure access, so that it isn't a day-to-day thing, secure access to enough nutritious food to have a productive and happy life. So part of this is getting this, there's public policy stuff, but there's also ethos stuff beneath public policy. And that is getting a kind of world stand that says hunger is no longer acceptable anywhere in the world. Regardless, yes, there's still going to be civil rights abuses, and yes, there's still going to be people in prison that shouldn't be. And those are bad things. But you had your hand up back there, and I kind of ignored it.
Back with Ethiopia again, what role is the Coptic Church playing now? Is it so subjugated that it can't do anything, or...?
Yeah, unfortunately, again, I don't know. I really don't know a lot about the Horn. That's one of the areas that I just haven't done much work on myself. And I don't usually get questions when I go out to my local groups about the Horn of Africa. So I haven't taken the time to be informed. Sorry, I don't know. We're out of time. I was going to share with you a letter, but we're out of time, that of a young woman who participated in a demonstration in D.C. About her being arrested and imprisoned and so forth. And it would have been an illustration of the other claim that I've tried to make. First claim is that politics, if you aren't working in politics, the politics is, let me state it positive rather than negative, politics is the way you change the structure. It's not the only way, maybe, but it is certainly the important way at a given moment. And the other claim is that political activity in behalf of justice is, thank you, political activity in behalf of justice is a religious calling, a religious vocation, and the bearer of spiritual experience, the enlargement of the arena of experience. When you win, I mean, Donald Trump wins, okay? But when you win in behalf of the poorest of the poor, you have won. And the fundamental satisfaction that comes from that transcends a satisfaction, I guess the closest thing I can get to it is holding a newborn. There's just that fundamental feeling of well-being that really your life has made some kind of difference in the grand scheme, and that people really are being helped. So I think it's a spiritual vocation. I'm over time. Got to quit. Need a break before the next session. Thank you for your hospitality today.